You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to video posted on Facebook. The person behind the camera is yelling at someone lying in a sleeping bag on the sidewalk.
Hey, wake up!
The person in the sleeping bag doesn't move. It looks in this video like a homeless person's being harassed, and the harasser is proud enough of it to record it and to post it publicly. It's just one example of what homeless people say they're experiencing, increasing hostility directed at them on the streets of Los Angeles. With encampments in nearly every neighborhood, a lot of residents feel frustrated, sad, helpless. Some are angry at having to walk around tents and see the trash and the filth. And according to people on the streets, a growing number are expressing their anger through honking horns, yelling, and other confrontational behavior. KCRW reporters Carla Green and Anna Scott are here to discuss it. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hey, Steve.
Carla, this is one incident that was caught on video. Did this go viral?
No, it didn't go viral. It was posted in a Facebook group. But what I've heard is that this kind of thing is growing more and more common. I've talked to a lot of people living on the streets and in their cars, and they say they've experienced this kind of thing more and more. I spoke to one woman named Brandy Wolf, who lives under an overpass in North Hollywood with her husband. She said that one time she was in the park down the street from where she lives. She was with her dog, and a man started yelling at her and threatened to kill her and her dog. She also said she gets honked at like that all the time.
People get out of their car and start yelling at us for being under the bridge. At 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 2 in the morning, when it's real late, people who are driving by, they'll honk their horns just to wake us up and then pull off. So they don't know me, they don't know my situation, and they're passing judgment on someone who is just going through a hard time in their life.
So I've heard a lot of stories like Brandy's. I've heard about people getting trash and rocks thrown at them at their cars. I've heard about people waking up in their cars to find nails in their tires. I spoke to Emily Weta Cantrum, who is a homeless advocate. She's an associate director at Safe Parking LA. And she says she's heard about a lot of things like that happening in the San Fernando Valley where Brandy lives.
We definitely have seen slashed tires, spray paint, dog poop. A lot of times people put things in other people's gas tanks if those are exposed. Photos that they've been sent of RVs that have had things spray painted, like literally get out, like that is spray painted on the side of an RV. If you're in an RV or you're in a vehicle, if something happens to that vehicle, that person will be living on the sidewalk. But I think this recent or gradual crossover into actual threats of violence are really incredibly concerning.
Anna, is there any way to put a number on this? I mean, do we know how often these types of things are happening?
Well, not really. It's really hard to quantify this in a concrete way. The LAPD only started in the past couple of years tracking the housing status of people involved in crimes. Since then, there's been a rise in crimes involving homeless victims and homeless suspects, but it's hard to break it down piece by piece to see how many incidents involve one person who's housed and one who isn't. But also, a lot of this doesn't really rise to the level where somebody's going to be calling 911, so that makes it hard to track. I mean, horns honking, people yelling, you know, it's not the kind of thing where anyone, I mean, would you call the police about that?
No, probably not. Have you spoken to anyone who's doing the yelling, though, who's doing the honking, whatever it is, because they're so angry?
Yes. And they're angry about exactly what you talked about in the intro, about the encampments that you see all over the city, about issues within the homeless population that they say elected officials and police are failing to address, such as drug use, disturbing behavior by people who appear mentally ill, and even crime. One of them is Demetrios Mavro Mikalis. He lives in Mar Vista.
Now the neighbors have teamed up in our neighborhood and we're literally forming vigilante groups. And I'm not saying going out there to hurt people, but because the police can't help us, our council members failed us miserably, we are empowering ourselves to go out there and police our own neighborhoods. And sometimes we are skating the laws a little bit because we might see something that doesn't belong there, like garbage. We think it's garbage, it looks like garbage, we throw it away. That happens to be somebody's belongings. There's no attacks on individuals. There's no harm. but we're going to make their lives miserable. Like, you cannot stay there and continue to break the laws that the police aren't enforcing right now. We're going to just put the spotlight on you. We're going to flash the lights on you. We're going to honk the horn, turn the sprinklers on. I'm sorry, this sounds mean, but again, these aren't the poor people that need housing. These are people that need divine intervention.
So, Steve, there are similar neighborhood patrol type groups that have popped up in the past year in Long Beach as well, also outside of LA, in Humboldt, in Santa Cruz, in Redding. And you hear a lot of the same arguments and concerns. And they're partly reacting to things they've observed or unpleasant encounters that they've had. But it's not accurate to characterize the entire homeless population of a city or even of one neighborhood as all criminals or all addicts or people who don't need housing. And I say that based on my own reporting on the streets, on official city and county data, and on police officers, including an LAPD captain that I talked to for this story, who works in the station that covers Mar Vista. He also said that when it comes to actual crime, the police do investigate and enforce that, but they're not going to investigate people for simply being homeless.
We know, Anna, that a good friend of anger is fear, right? And people feel afraid of the encampments, all those tents. They feel like perhaps they're being threatened in some way.
Yeah, fear is definitely a part of it. And sometimes homeless people do act out in ways that are intimidating. Sometimes they commit crimes or harass people. But most unhoused people in Los Angeles are not criminals, and overall, they're an extremely vulnerable population. They're more likely to be victims of crime than housed residents. Homeless people make up just 1% of the city's population, but 16% of its murder victims last year. And the homeless population of Los Angeles includes a lot of former foster youth, a lot of victims of domestic violence, people who have been discriminated against in a variety of ways and who are not only physically but psychologically very vulnerable.
And there they lay, right? Physically vulnerable for anybody to harass on the streets. Carla, that video we heard at the beginning, you saw it on Facebook. I want to talk about social media and how social media plays into all of this.
Yeah, if you want to hear about how it played into it, I have a piece of tape for you to listen to.
All right, so what are we listening to?
So we are at a meeting in Topanga. As you can hear, it was a little bit tense. The meeting was about a couple of Facebook groups that were kind of ostensibly about crime and the homelessness crisis in the West San Fernando Valley. Basically, what happened was activists and then the media published a series of screenshots from these groups with comments from group members that were honestly pretty disturbing, pretty hateful. There were people saying they wanted to use a fire hose on homeless people, throw dog excrement at them, go after them with bats. There were comments calling homeless people zombies. People who defend the Facebook group say, you know, the comments came from just a couple of bad apples. Those bad apples were banned from the group. And also that no one would ever act on what they said in these groups. So I spoke to one guy named Steve Slutza, who lives in the Valley. He's a member of at least one of these Facebook groups. And he says he doesn't approve of the violent comments, but also that they weren't real threats.
It is a place for people, you might say, to blow off some steam and to also communicate and commiserate with people, each other, to find out that we all are suffering from the same types of problems. Okay, I can show you a picture right down the street of a sidewalk that's totally blocked. I can show you crack pipes that are laying on the sidewalk that I can't walk past because the sidewalk is entirely blocked. I can show you large butcher knives that are laying there. These are things that affect the quality of life, my quality of life.
So part of the reason this meeting was happening was because local police officers were in these Facebook groups. And once the comments were made public, LAPD bosses ordered them to leave. But Steve Slutza, like a lot of people at the meeting, wanted the officers to rejoin the Facebook groups.
As a matter of fact, psychologically, this site kept a lot of people probably from doing things because they knew the police were involved and were doing something to help them. Vigilantes become vigilantes because they feel there's no other way other than doing it themselves. But we're not dealing with it properly. Our government is failing us. They've wasted money. They're not putting people into shelters the way they need to, and we need to do something about it.
In Eagle Rock, Carla, two men were arrested for recently setting a homeless encampment on fire. That kind of extreme violence, I guess, is rare, But do you know of any other violent incidents connected to this kind of vigilantism that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I actually, unfortunately, have heard stories of people being violently attacked.
There is somewhat of an elitist point of view, certain people, a standpoint that certain people like to take. They like to harass the homeless. You know, I think it makes them feel good. I've literally seen and been again on the receiving end of spoiled eggs, physical attacks.
All right, who's that?
So this is a guy named Chris. He asked not to use his last name because he's worried about being targeted. He's this young, blonde, charming guy. He lives in an encampment in a park in North Hollywood, just up the street from where Brandy Wolf lives with her husband. And Chris says that he has been attacked 3 or 4 times in the year and a half that he's been homeless. The most recent time was about 3 months ago when he was with an elderly friend of his.
We both were attacked and were cursed at. Being instructed to get the F out of here, get the F on, while being physically accosted. I had a television thrown at my head while I was sleeping. My ear was bleeding. Thank God it didn't hit my face. And they threw a full trash can at an elderly woman. I affectionately called Mom. It was horrible, you know, just because of the amount of hatred and not only just waking up, but not really understanding what you did wrong. The aftershock is the worst, where you don't know who to trust anymore.
Since that happened to you, like while you were sleeping, has that changed the way that you sleep at all since it happened?
Definitely, 100%. I do have night terrors now. I do worry about things. I'm a lot less open and forthcoming with people. Unfortunately, I try not to sleep, and it sucks. You can't dream if you don't sleep, and I'm a dreamer. So,
Anna, when we take a step back and we look at the general anger around homelessness, does it have an impact, do you think, on what cities actually do about the issue?
Yeah, emotions are really tied into policy when it comes to homelessness. You see it with opposition to new shelters and housing in some neighborhoods. That's a real obstacle to getting these facilities built. And it's not just in Los Angeles, but around the country in cities and counties where homelessness has become more visible, that has gone hand in hand with laws criminalizing things like living in vehicles, panhandling, sleeping on the sidewalks, including to some degree here in LA. Now, there's research by the National Coalition for the Homeless that finds a correlation between these laws and violence directed at homeless people. And their argument is that these laws create a narrative, feed into a narrative that homeless people are inherently dangerous, and that it becomes this kind of feedback loop. And the thing that you've seen play out here in Los Angeles is city officials being caught between the pressure to crack down on encampments and turning to criminalization in some cases, and on the other hand, facing huge criticism for the same measures for being inhumane and ineffective. And what you end up with sometimes is a patchwork of policies that are aimed at satisfying different constituencies in the short term more than a reliance on strategies that really get to the root of the problem and are backed up by data and research.
The bottom line, Anna and Carla, is that it seems like it's a very scary time to be visibly homeless in LA, a vulnerable time for people on the streets.
Yep. Yeah.
KCRW's Anna Scott and Carla Green reporting for us. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, coming up, part of a 50-year-old mystery at LA's Central Library is solved. Sort of. You're hearing Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. If you're a true crime aficionado, this next story is for you. A 50-year-old cold case has been solved. Well, partially solved anyway. 1969 was the year, and a bronze sculpture called the Well of Scribes went missing from the Los Angeles Public Library. It was never seen again until now. Part of the sculpture resurfaced in Arizona, and it's currently on its way back home. Finally, here to tell us the tale is Brandon Reynolds, who's a journalist and self-described cultural spelunker. Hey, Brandon.
Hi, how are you?
All right. I don't know. Is it a theft? Is it a disappearance? What would you call it?
The disappearance itself happened in 1969. The library at the time had a number of problems, one of which was that there was no parking for the librarians, and they were threatening a mutiny. So the city said, all right, we'll give you a parking lot. So they tore out the west lawn, of which the Well of Scribes was a part, kind of the frontispiece of the whole thing. And then it just disappeared.
How does that go missing, though? I mean,
exactly. You would think it's about it looks like it must be about 8 to 10 foot curving basin, and then on the front there's all of these historical scribes that are converging on a Pegasus.
But someone decided that it was gone, right?
I mean,
I mean, over the years, they realized it was gone.
Yeah, at some point people would say, "Hey, you remember that well? Whatever happened to it?" And then somebody. They'd be like, I have no idea. And so these theories have emerged. One was that it was melted down for scrap because it was made of bronze. And over the years, bronze has been very valuable. One was that somebody, you know, in Beverly Hills got it and put it in their backyard. And then the third option is just that the city put it in a yard or warehouse somewhere, a la the Ark of the Covenant, and it disappeared. But beyond that, nobody had any. There was no paper trail. There was no sense of anything. Just gone.
Do we know when the true investigation happened?
Shocking. Let me get back in my chair.
I mean, when did somebody say, hey, we need to find this thing?
The conversation really got started again in the 80s after the two library fires. They were deciding they wanted to fix up the library, and there was a big push to renovate and to restore this west lawn, including putting the well back. And then somebody said, where's the well? And then they said, we don't know where the well is. And so at that point, there was a mad scramble to do absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right? Hurry up and wait.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And so there is a Well of Scribes there now that was made by an artist named Judd Fine, which is very nice. And so it replicates in some ways the thing, but it's a different well altogether.
And lo and behold, 50 years later,
50 years.
Here we are in the great state of Arizona, the Grand Canyon state, in a town, what is it?
Bisbee, Arizona. So there's a man in Bisbee named Floyd Lillard. He was an antiques dealer. He was in Denver for many years, and then he ended up in Bisbee. And he would buy stuff just from people all around the area, all around the kind of southern Arizona area. And he had a real eye for stuff. And he bought this piece from this woman's garden and paid $500 for it and took it home. And because he had been spending his entire career recognizing the value of these things, he knew it was something special. But he didn't know what. And so he would, over the years, this has been about 10 years now, over the years, he would do a Google search, you know, for like bronze. And the woman that he bought it from said that her father worked for the city of Los Angeles. So he said, aha.
Uh-huh.
And he looked around, and he thought maybe it had something to do with the library. He called the library at one point years ago, and they didn't know what he was talking about. So then my story comes out in July. The story I write is just about this whole mystery. And somebody sends it to him, and he finally sees a picture of it. He says, aha, that's what I have, or at least part of what I have. You know, so what Floyd has is the Western scribe. So it's an Aztec, a Native American, a Franciscan monk, a Greek, a Roman, and something else. Anyway, and they're all with their writing implements.
These are like civilizations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's supposed to represent the march of learning toward this sort of central point, which is, ta-da, the L.A. Central Library.
Right.
But anyway, he's got that piece. So there's still a bunch of Eastern scribes missing and a Pegasus.
And a horse.
And the Pegasus is still out there, yeah. So,
is there a way we can find the name of the woman?
Floyd has promised me that he's going to go through his receipts. He's got 20 or 30 years of receipts. So, and I was just out there.
That's a lot of paper, by the way.
Yeah, I was just out there last week, and I was sort of trying to press him on it. But, you know, he's trying to sell his business and everything, so everything's up in the air. But I'm willing to go through all this with you to find this person's name.
And I suspect, you know, I mean, Floyd saw your piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to be the guy who wrote something that sparked this in the first place?
I think it's great. You know, it's also nice to be riding on Susan Orlane's coattails. I mean, she wrote the library book, which was about the library, and had a single reference to the Well
of Scribes. Just one reference to it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then my editor, Blaze, said, I like this. And he does this cold case column for the magazine, Alta. Yeah. And then he said, why don't you see if you can find it? And the other mysteries, the other cold cases in the magazine have been things like airships in the 1800s, like stuff that we're not necessarily going to solve. But this one, it seemed like there was maybe a chance to get to the bottom
of
it.
Did you think you could solve it?
I really did. I don't know why.
Did you really?
Yeah. I thought if it's valuable, there's no reason why. And in fact, the librarian, John Szabo, he told me this story about he was taken out into Griffith Park by a councilman. And he thought that the councilman was going to murder him. The councilman went digging into the underbrush and pulled out an old giant stone Los Angeles Central Library sign, like the sign that had just been dumped in the middle of Griffith Park.
After the fire or what? Or was this...
After, I think when they did that, when they did the renovations in 69.
Oh, in 69. Yeah. Way before the fire.
Yeah. When the well came out, this sign also went missing. And the sign is this giant stone thing. And somebody just dumped it in Griffith Park. So it was there. So when I knew that, I was like, well, yeah, why not? Maybe the city loses stuff all the time.
Right.
Why not?
Right. Whatever happened to that, to the sign, to the library sign?
Oh, John took it out and he actually mounted it in front of one of the regional libraries. So it is there. It is represented.
So it was restored. It was restored mm-hmm. and put back somewhere in the library system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's in front of one.
Did you, like in your heart of hearts, did you think that this was something insidious, something really, you know? I think we're overdoing that, aren't we?
Oh, I think it's great.
Do you?
I think we're into the third act, and we're going to find out that it was one of us that did it.
No.
Do I think so? No, I mean, I think that if anything, it was opportunities. You know, the city was tearing the stuff out and clearly had indicated that it was valueless. You know, they're like, we don't care about this. The more important thing is parking, which I think is very, very LA
so LA.
Let's take this relic and dump it and, you know, but we got to have more parking downtown. Right. That's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the good news is that Western civilization has been reestablished now at the library.
That's correct.
That's the good news. Mm-hmm. The bad news is Eastern civilization is still missing.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Pegasus and the mm-hmm. horse. The thing that has turned up will be unveiled?
That's right.
Yeah, tomorrow.
It's back, and they're going to do an unveiling tomorrow at the library at 10 a.m. I mean, and the thing that's important about it is that it was in part designed by this fellow Lee Lowry, and he designed the Atlas that's in Rockefeller Center. So this is a piece of a legitimate sculptor's collection. And,
right.
And also a piece of Los Angeles history.
And it went lost or got stolen mm-hmm. or something.
Something happened to it.
And the mystery continues.
Mystery continues. Yeah, we're about a third of the way solved.
If someone's listening to our voices right now, and they have perhaps Eastern civilization in their mm-hmm. in their possession, mm-hmm. Is there a place to get in touch with you?
Sure. DM me on Twitter, Sunny Borderland at Twitter.
Sunny? S-O-N?
S-O-N-N-Y Borderland on Twitter. Why?
On Twitter.
Because that's an anagram of Brandon Reynolds.
Brandon Reynolds, who's a journalist for the Journal of Alta, California. Brandon, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, man. Always take it just one step further. One step further, Steve. Let's talk baseball for a moment. The Blue Crew, that is the Los Angeles Dodgers, won a dominant 106 games in the regular season. Their best regular season record in franchise history, going back to Brooklyn Christian Bordahl, all the way to Brooklyn in 1884, if you can believe it. They scored the most runs, allowed the fewest of any National League team this season.
Yeah, pretty impressive. But, you know, none of that is going to matter anymore because tonight they're going to face the Washington Nationals and the season is over. So now it's all about the postseason.
It's all about the postseason. They face the Nationals. They have home field advantage. If they win this series, they go on to the championship series. Beyond that, then perhaps, knock wood, the World Series beyond that.
Yeah, and hopefully if they get that far, they do a little better this year than they have in the last two.
Yeah. Yeah, we know what happened in the last two. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you.
Sure.
I thought this segment was going to be longer than this. But lo and behold, our program has come to an end. Next week, By the way, an increasing number of people, grown adults, are living at home with their parents in one town in Southern California whose mayor is a dog. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christian Bordahl, Christine Comita, they all make this program happen each and every day. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're online, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Thanks for your ear today. Have a great day.